It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we celebrate the Wisconsin tradition of the Door County Fish Boil, and we ask a master boiler how to have one at home.
First, it has been 2 weeks since the United States began airstrikes against the Islamic militant group ISIS in Iraq, and news about the group has continued to make headlines throughout the week.
A YouTube video emerged Tuesday of a member of ISIS beheading American journalist James Foley. And President Obama responded, saying the U.S. will be vigilant and relentless and will do what it must to protect its people.
Yesterday, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said the group is beyond just a terrorist group, calling it as sophisticated and well-funded as any group that we have seen.
U.S. Senator Ron Johnson also joined the national conversation. He has been holding town hall meetings around the state this week to warn Wisconsinites about what he calls a gathering storm to strike America.
Senator Johnson is a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he joins us now to talk about possible threats posed by ISIS. Senator Johnson, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, Veronica, hello, Cynthia. How are you doing?
Doing well. Glad you could be here. Now, you've been holding town hall meetings this week to warn Americans about ISIS. Now, we're a country who's lived through September 11th, through orange threats, red threats, shoe bombers. Why do we need to be on high alert all over again?
Well, to be accurate, I hold my town hall meetings primarily talking about the dangers of our fiscal mismanagement, the record deficits and accumulating debt. But, you know, Wisconsinites are very concerned about what's happening throughout the world, not only just in Iraq, but Syria and Ukraine, and certainly between Israel and Hamas. But we've been getting an awful lot of questions, and I have been, because I've been on the Foreign Relations Committee. We've held hearings on exactly what's been happening, not only in Syria, but now as we're seeing ISIS spill out of Syria into Iraq. We're really witnessing, to a certain extent, the disintegration of the state of Iraq, and this is a gathering storm. ISIS, as Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said, these are evil people. They are barbarians. They cannot be contained. They're very well disciplined. They're very strategic. They've been very patient setting up this caliphate. And they've been very clear in terms of what their long-term aims are. It really is to utilize that caliphate, that state, as a base of operations against the West. I have no idea why they want to destroy Western culture, but that is exactly what they want to do. They were so extreme, ISIS, that they were actually kicked out of Al-Qaeda. So this is not a group that can be contained. It's a group that needs to be defeated.
This week we've been seeing stories about the number of Westerners, Americans, and British nationals who may be part of ISIS. What kinds of specific threats do you see ISIS posing to the United States right now?
Well, we had Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Brett McGurk in front of our Foreign Relations Committee on July 24th, and I asked him the specific question, what threat does ISIS represent to America? And this is basically he described it. He said, ISIS is funneling 30 to 50 suicide bombers into Iraq per month. And what ISIS is also doing is they are recruiting jihadists from around the world. But we've already got, I think, intelligence communities have documented hundreds of jihadists into Syria with Western passports. And so the point that Mr. McGurk made was that it'd be easy for ISIS to start funneling those suicide bombers into Western countries. And actually, the week he testified, there were two Western suicide bombers, one from Australia, one from Germany, that set themselves off in Baghdad. And of course, we've already witnessed the first American bred suicide bomber fell from Florida after training in Syria, went back to Florida, but came back and blew himself up in Syria in May. So that is exactly one of the things we have to worry about is the jihadists bringing the battle to the West, to America.
And at these town hall meetings where you're talking about these threats, how do people respond?
Well, they're highly concerned, and they need to be concerned. And I've just been describing the situation as it's been relayed to us through testimony in the Foreign Relations Department. And you know, we're witnessing, because of our debt and deficit, remember former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, said that the greatest threat to our national security is our debt and deficit. It makes us economically weak. And if we're economically weak, we can't be militarily strong either. And so, you know, we're witnessing enormous pressure on our budgets, including our defense budget. This is no time to be hollowing our military. We have to be very strategic in how we structure our forces. We have to recognize the asymmetric threat that terrorism represents to America. And we need to be smart about this. And we have to, the first thing we have to do is not deny reality. We have to recognize the danger And I am concerned. You know, President Obama, when ISIS took over Fallujah back in January, his comment was, oh, you know, they're the JV team. Just because they're putting on a Lakers uniform doesn't make them Kobe Bryant. So that is really giving, you know, not paying the type of attention, not giving the serious consideration to the threat that ISIS represents. And, you know, it's unfortunate that it took the videotaping of the beheading of an American journalist, Jim Foley, to, I guess, grab President Obama's attention enough to actually make a statement. I appreciate the fact that he's taken some action when he had to prevent the genocide of the Yazidis and help the Kurds, the Peshmerga, take back the Mosul Dam.
Well, let's talk about
that's just the minimum action that has to be taken.
I want to talk about those airstrikes because right now those airstrikes are helping to retake some of northern Iraq. But should the situation deteriorate, given the seriousness of the situation that you just described with ISIS, would you support U.S. military intervention on the ground?
Well, of course, what we should have done is exactly what we did after World War II. And after the Korean War, leave stabilizing forces behind in Iraq, and we didn't do that. When we left Iraq, we left our ability to influence the coalition government, and this never should have happened, but it's happening. We defeated al-Qaeda in Iraq once when we had 168,000 troops during that surge, when al-Qaeda in Iraq was about 68,000 troops. Now ISIS is 15 to 17,000 troops. They're better resourced. They're better trained. They're far more effective. And so what I think President Obama needs to do is he needs to get off the golf course, get on the phone, and he needs to start assembling that coalition of a willing of Western nations as well as Arab states that are threatened directly by this gathering storm that is ISIS. And we need to assemble that coalition of the willing, and we have to have as our primary objective their defeat.
And I want to press you a little bit on that, though. Given the seriousness of the threat that you're describing and perhaps attacks on American soil, would you support troops on the ground if the situation continues to deteriorate?
As part of a coalition effort, I think that's what we're going to have to anticipate. And I think Defense Secretary Hagel is saying as much just yesterday in his statements. I think this administration is finally coming to the realization that it was a huge mistake not to leave a stabilizing force to allow ISIS to reform from al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they have to be dealt with. They can't be contained. They have to be defeated. But again, we'll try and do it by providing resources and backup to the Kurdish Peshmerga, certainly to the Iraqi forces. But again, as was told to us in testimony, ISIS is more than double the size of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And remember, we had 168,000 American troops it took to defeat al-Qaeda in Iraq back in 2007. So this isn't going to be some little pinprick measure. You know, air power alone is not going to defeat ISIS. And I think people are coming to the conclusion that it cannot be contained. It's going to have to be defeated. Again, I can't tell you exactly how we're going to be doing it, but we should be doing what President Obama should be doing, what President Bush did, is assemble a coalition of the willing, get the UN behind this, and recognize that the danger that ISIS represents to the entire free world.
Now, what you're saying is provocative. Right now, we're hearing that there is no one out there from the United States who has the appetite to have more on-the-ground involvement in Iraq. But you're saying with the coalition of the willing, you think it is the place of the United States to join that coalition on the ground to eradicate ISIS.
Well, we can sit back and we can wait for terrorists to strike here in America. Is that what we really want to do? I really don't. You remember, we denied, we buried our head in the sands in the 90s when al-Qaeda declared war on us, and we didn't take out Osama bin Laden when we had the opportunity to. And we allowed the threat of al-Qaeda to gather and finally strike America and slaughtered a couple thousand Americans when the Twin Towers came down. I mean, is it going to take another terrorist attack in America? And by the way, I would consider the beheading of an American journalist a terrorist attack on this nation.
And so given that terrorist attack on the nation that you're talking about, the situation, the possibility of strikes against America on homeland soil, are you advocating for action now? Is it possible that if we wait too late, that the chance will be lost to contain the damage?
Yes, we've already waited too late. We never should have left Iraq. We should have left a stabilizing force behind, and we are paying the consequences of that because of that strategic, historic blunder. And so let's not make another strategic historic blunder by continuing to ignore this threat. I mean, the fact of the matter is America is already engaged in Iraq. We are bombing. We are at war with ISIS. You know, and if we don't recognize that fact, I mean, again, we're just denying reality. We already have close to 1,000 troops in Iraq right now. You know, they may not be engaged specifically firing rifles at ISIS, but my guess is they're certainly gathering intelligence. My guess is they're certainly helping to spot and direct targeting the attacks from our bombers. So we are engaged. I don't know. I'm not a military expert. I don't know to what extent we're going to have to engage. All I'm saying is our goal should be clearly articulated, and our goal should be the defeat of ISIS because they cannot be contained.
There is no plan on the table right now to eradicate ISIS. As I understand it, there is simply the airstrikes planned. Given that, what is your priority number one, do you think, for dealing with ISIS when you get back to Washington?
Well, the first thing we have to do is we have to make sure whatever part of Iraq is stabilized, we do everything we can to keep it stabilized. In other words, and I've been advocating this for really a couple of months, is we need to resource the Peshmerga, the Kurdish troops. We have to make sure that they are armed, they have adequate resources to stabilize and protect the Kurdish region. We better make sure that Jordan remains a sovereign nation, that ISIS doesn't start looking at Jordan and start destabilizing that, and we need to certainly protect all of our Americans in that region, including in Baghdad. So that's the first step. But the next step, again, is to have President Obama begin to assemble that coalition of the willing, and then, you know, exactly what the strategy will be, exactly what the force structure, whether it's going to be NATO type of structure. I believe our goal has to be the defeat of ISIS.
Senator Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
Have a great day.
We've been speaking with U.S. Senator Ron Johnson about the militant group ISIS. He's been holding town hall meetings around the state this week to warn Wisconsinites about the possible threat from the group. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Anyone who's experienced a fish boil will likely never forget the experience. The spectacle of leaping flames around a huge cauldron of boiling water is a longtime tradition in Door County.
And while Door County is the birthplace of the fish boil, we'll learn how to make one at home, minus the flames. With us now is Dan Peterson from the Viking Grill in Ellison Bay, Door County. He's been a master boiler for 50 years. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
So, Dan, where did this tradition of the Door County fish boil come from?
Well, that's very hard to say, but you have to imagine that the loggers were here first, and they had a lot of fish, and they had the boats and everything. So it was what they did, I guess, just went out and caught some fish, and they had a big pot, and there's a lot of people working. It's a meal served to a lot of people in a short time, and it's just delicious. But I believe it was probably in 1800s is when it started.
And, of course, now we can see it all over the country, as far afield as Pennsylvania. Why don't you describe it for us and why, you know, it's such got such a wide appeal?
Well, it's a Door County tradition as you see it right now. And it started here at the Viking in about 1960-61. Lawrence Annette Wickman started just to raise their business a little bit. Before that, it was done in church areas and for groups like that anyway. But it's to do it in our situation here, we have a cauldron and we have about 20 gallons of water and big baskets and everything like that. But it's not necessary to boil it. You can use your big chili pot at home, take your little colander and put some potatoes and some onions and some fish in it. And it's all timed, cooking time. It takes about 24 minutes for the whole process. It takes a lot of salt. It kind of scares people, the amount of salt. And you certainly don't want to do a boil over on your stove, not before you call your fire department at least. So, but it is a great meal. It's served with butter over it, and along with the lemons and cherry pie for dessert. It is a meal that people will remember without a doubt.
Now, part of what's so memorable is the preparation, is this incredible tower of flames that comes when the fish start boiling in that water. Now, that's not really something you want to be trying at home, but is there a way to replicate that experience?
Well, what it is during the cooking process, there's oil in the fish. And oil being lighter than water, it settles on the top. With the washing of the sweet red potatoes and the onions, it turns into a gray or brown matter. So what we do is we intensify the boil by throwing fuel oil on the fire. On the fire, I repeat that, not in the pot. And it enhances the boil so great it just froths over. It lasts about 4 or 5 seconds. And while it's frothing over, we take the food out. So, but you don't want to do that at home.
It sounds like if you take one wrong move, it could be a disaster. Have you had any close calls yourself?
Well, yes, the wind has changed a couple different times, and that's tough. But you have to remember, use fuel oil. Now, somebody will come by and say, well, how much gas do you use? You're going to use gas once, and that's a big mistake. So, but it is an awesome good meal. Really
is there a fish boil season? Is it better done in fall, given the nature of the flames?
Actually, the best time of the year is probably when the fish comes out of the cold winter water. But we do the fish boil here. We open in April, and I do a fish boil every Friday till the end of December. And during the summer, we do it 3, 4, 5 days a week, depending on the demand.
Now, take us through a bit of the recipe step by step. I noticed that the timing of when to add each ingredient is quite exact. Why is that?
Well, because of the cooking time. Now, when we start, I'll do it with our cauldron here, with 20 gallons of water. The first thing we put in is about 3 pounds of salt. We bring that water to a boil, and the next thing that goes in is about 25 pounds of potatoes and another pound of salt. We'll cook those potatoes about 8-10 minutes, and then we put our onions in. They're sweet, small onions, and we cook those about 8 minutes. And then it's time for the fish to go in. Now, all this cooking time is boil time. It's not just in the water. It's boil time. And we put the fish in, and we'll cook those 8 to 10 minutes, depending on the size and things like that. And then at the very end, we have our tradition. We ring the bell 1 minute before we're going to boil it over so people can get their Kodak moment or whatever it is. And poof, big flame comes up. And it's kind of scary, but it's very much in control here.
Now, I've heard people say that the thing about the fish boil is the drama of it, that tower of flame. Can you make the case that the food is actually delicious, that throwing stuff into boiling water actually produces tasty food?
Well, you know, a lot of people boil things and they think it's real good when they're boiling it in grease in a French fryer. Now, you take boiling it in water, you make your choice. What would you rather have?
Mm-hmm. Well, one is healthier.
Well, it certainly is, and it is so good. Prepared properly, it's just a magnificent meal.
And then I guess you've got all that melted butter on top.
Well, yeah, that's maybe cheating a little bit, but it's Wisconsin butter, so that's all right.
So if I did my math correctly, the fish itself only boils for about 10 minutes.
That's correct.
And that's enough?
That is enough. You could... In a cooking process, you can tell with our big cauldrons we have, you can see about 4 or 5 minutes into the cooking, the fish will start to float just a little bit. And it's one of the indicators of that your boil's coming along good and the fish is cooking just right. So,
now, you've been doing this for 50 years. That's a long time. Does it ever get old, or is it something that's always fresh and exciting?
Actually, probably longer than that, but my brother and I were like 9 or 10 years old when we first started helping my father over in Bailey's Harbor. It was just a thing that we did once in a while. It was called a trout boil back then. And we were left outside to keep the fire going. It was done in a big wash tub with some wire crimped together. Nowadays, everything is stainless steel and much safer and healthier, I would say. But it's quite a treat.
And what would you say to someone who's trying to think about how to do this at home in just our last 30 seconds here?
Well, you just use your chili pot, like I said. Fill it with water. Take your little colander and put your potatoes in. It's a serving for 8, but 16 chunks of fish, you know, small onions, 16 onions and 16 potatoes, and Well, a lot of salt, though. You start with a quarter pound and then another little quarter pound and another quarter pound on each time. And don't boil it over.
And I've got a little taste.
And rinse it.
A little taste of Door County. Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you.
That was Dan Peterson, Master Fish Boiler from the Viking Grill in Ellison Bay, Door County. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
We've come upon that time of year when we usually ask ourselves, where did the summer go? We're sure you did some amazing things, created lots of memories. Did you enjoy them? I mean, really enjoy them? In the age of selfies and Instagram, people are constantly posting and sharing their adventures online.
What memories did you create this summer? Were you posting on social media during all your summer adventures, or did you do your best to unplug to stay off the internet? And how did it go? How do you think social media has changed the way we experience travel and summertime? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us email to talk@wpr.org.
Our next guest asks if we were too busy tweeting about our adventures rather than living in the moment. Danny Heitman is a columnist for the Advocate newspaper in Louisiana. He recently wrote an opinion piece for the Wall Street Journal called "Have You Twittered Away Your Summer?" Danny, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, hi. It's good to be here today. Happy summer to you.
Happy summer to you. So let's start with the quote that you shared from Mark Twain in that piece in the Wall Street Journal. In your piece, the Sacramento Union had sponsored a trip to Hawaii on the condition that Twain send dispatches from his time there. What did he have to say about missing deadlines?
Well, he was supposed to document his experiences more or less as they happened, and he filed his copy late, and he said he had basically gone to Maui, had a great time, and he said, "I would not have fooled away any of it writing letters under any consideration whatever. He basically said, "I wasn't going to waste time writing about my experiences. I wanted to enjoy them." And as I mentioned in my piece, as a newspaper man, I would be reluctant to take that advice. I might get fired. But his larger point was that it's more important to enjoy an experience than to fuss over documenting it. And so in my opinion piece, I explored what balance do we strike between actually enjoying our summer vacation and then trying to tweet about it or post things about it to Facebook and Instagram. And I don't think that, you know, you have to do it all one way or all the other, but I do think it's an important balance that you have to strike. So,
well, and how did you find that you can strike that balance? Is it fair to say that you can't thoroughly enjoy your vacation if you're busy documenting it?
In my particular instance, this tension really rests squarely in the middle of the relationship I have with my wife, who is a lady I just dearly love. But she is the recording secretary of our family, so she is the person who is going to be taking pictures of us while we're kayaking or while we're enjoying a meal, while we're traveling, while we're sightseeing. And thank goodness that she does that, because if she didn't, we wouldn't have any pictures at all. I'm more the person who's living in the moment, and I live so much in the moment that I'm not thinking about posterity. I'm not thinking about that day that's going to come, you know, later in the year when the summer is over and there are no pictures at all in the scrapbook because Danny forgot to take pictures. So I'm glad that my wife documents those things, but sometimes, you know, I'm cautioning her, hey, maybe we're spending a little bit too much time taking pictures of the experience instead of enjoying the experience themselves. And in my piece, I don't really offer people a precise formula for working this out, but I do raise the question about what is your comfort level? To what degree do you think you should document your summer fun and to what degree you think you should just go ahead and enjoy it. And I think it's an issue that has become more prominent now that we all have iPhones, mm-hmm. With cameras on them. So that I think this kind of self-documentation, the whole selfie culture, it's just a lot more intuitive for us. We just do it without thinking about it. And part of the reason for me writing this piece was to get us thinking about it. So.
Well, on the one hand, if we don't take pictures of our adventures, if we don't write about them, then all we have to rely on is our memory, and we could have a really good memory, a really bad one. I'm curious as being someone who likes to live in the moment, and you're not typically the one that takes pictures of your vacations, and it's your wife that's doing that. Do you find that if you didn't have a camera at all, or if you didn't have your wife there to help record the adventures that you've been going on and the things that you've been doing, would you remember them as well if you didn't have those pictures to look back on?
Well, something interesting happened to us. We did go kayaking. We were not, when we were on vacation in North Carolina this summer, we were not able to bring our smartphones or any kind of electronics with us because we didn't want that equipment to get wet. Mm-hmm. So we had to rely on our five senses to just basically imprint this experience onto our memories. And I found that just the fact that I didn't have these recording devices with me sort of forced me to really be more aware of my surroundings. And, you know, my mom used to say that she thought calculators had sort of inhibited our ability to do math on our own. And not that she was against calculators, but she did raise this interesting issue: to what degree does technology empower you, and to what degree does it sometimes disempower you? And I do think the fact that we can take pictures sometimes prevents us from actually trying to commit this image to our memories that we have up in our old noggin. And so I would just raise that issue, is to just throw that out, is that, you know, sometimes not having a camera forces you to remember something in a different way. It's not that it's necessarily better or worse, but it's just a different way, and it's important for us to connect with that from time to time, too.
Mm-hmm. How has the rise of the smartphone and technology changed the way that we live in the moment or not?
I noticed that with my kids, of course, and this is not an original observation, that they are sometimes so connected to their technology that they're really not aware of their surroundings. You know, part of the reason we go on vacation is to experience other landscapes, other cultures. And if you're constantly connected to a device, then, you know, you might as well be back home. You know, is one way to look at it. My colleague Walt Handelsman, who's a great newspaper cartoonist, he recalled this experience that he had in visiting upstate New York, where it was a beautiful lake that he was looking at. And he looked over to his left, and there were two young people sitting in front of this beautiful lake, and they were both on their laptops. And he felt that, you know, the real experience of this place was really lost on them because they were so immersed in their technology. So I think technology is a tool, and like any tool, it can be used or perhaps misused. And I think it's just important for us to be in control of our technology instead of our technology being in control of us. You know, Henry David Thoreau famously said, "We are tools of our tools." And what he meant is that the tools were running us instead of us, you know, bossing the tools. Mm-hmm. So all those things are worth considering.
Well, smartphones now have essentially become cameras. And I think people just have stopped buying cameras because of it. And now when you're out with your friends or whatever, people are just taking pictures on their phones and it becomes the de facto camera. Would you recommend, as a means of disconnecting and really enjoying those vacations away from home, in investing in an actual camera? Should that still be part of our, you know, packed in our suitcase?
We do have a camera that we use. I think maybe the better solution is to just put yourself on a smartphone diet. I brought my smartphone on my vacation, and gosh, I'm really glad I did it, because the ability to occasionally connect with my home and my office as I traveled actually enhanced my vacation and allowed me to have a greater sense of ease, because I was able to answer a few emails and connect with folks. So I'm not against smartphones, but what I did try to do on my vacation was put that smartphone away from time to time. Mm-hmm. And by not being so connected to it all the time and sort of putting myself on a smartphone diet, I was actually able to enjoy my vacation more. But it's something I continue to struggle with, and I think all of us do. And it's all about striking the right balance, and that balance can differ from person to person.
It's funny, I feel like I'm the only person in my family that will take an actual camera on the camping trip or have it, you know, sling it around my neck while everyone else is just holding out their iPhones and stuff. So I feel like a dinosaur in a way. It is a digital camera, though, I will say that. We're talking with writer Danny Heitman. He recently wrote an opinion piece called "Have You Twittered Away Your Summer?" We want to hear from you. Did you make a specific effort not to stay tethered to social media while enjoying your summer vacations, your adventures, your long weekends? Or do you enjoy tweeting and posting about your daily goings-on? Is it important to you to remain connected, and why? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also send us an email at talk@WPR.org. We'll hear your summer stories right after this check of the news with Kristen Durst from the WPR News Department. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. As summer winds down, we're reflecting on the trips we took, the memories we made, and whether we were truly living in the moment. Writer Danny Heitman recently wrote an op-ed column called "Did You Twitter Away Your Summer?" And now we turn that question to you. Do you make a point to live in the moment, to keep your updates and your photos offline until after they're over? Or is posting about your adventures a way to document the stories before you forget about them? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. Danny, let's start by taking a call from Ellen in Milwaukee. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
Hi. What's your reflection on summer?
Just on summer and just in general with the idea of the posting and the twittering, sometimes I wonder if all of this posting and living out loud, so to speak, if it makes us forget that we all need a little bit of privacy. And sometimes these really special, glorious moments that we have, if they're that special and important, some of them should be private, and I see my kids just putting everything out there all the time. And you lose a space. There's no space between your own little experience and the world out there. So that's just my idea. So mm-hmm. I'll just hang up and listen to what you think, Ellen. About that.
Yeah, Danny, what do you think about that? Do you think there should be a proportionate relationship between privacy and those special moments?
It's something that I have been struggling with for, I guess, 25 years now, because even before the social media revolution, a lot of the work that I did as a columnist for the newspaper was writing about my family life. And I've written about certain family moments because I feel that it might be a source of connection with other people who've had similar moments in their families, and it might actually be affirming for them. At the same time, there have been occasions where I felt, I'm gonna draw a line here. I'm not going to write about this experience because I do indeed feel that this is an intimate moment and that to some degree I would commodify it if I shared it with a larger world. And in some ways, I feel that with the social media revolution, we've all become writers. We have all become filmmakers, and we're all struggling with the same things that writers and filmmakers have been struggling with for a long time. And I do think that the caller makes a really valid point about the need to share some save some moments for yourself. I also think that people feel compelled to document things sometimes because there's a sense that life is fleeting and that if somehow you can take a picture of it or you can write about it, that that moment is not lost. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's an especially urgent feeling I think we get in summer. And also during the Yuletide holidays, we have a sense that these times are not going to last forever, and we feel like we have more control over them if we can document them. But at the same time, if you document them too much, then you're actually losing an essence of that experience. So it's just a bargain we all have to strike. Mm-hmm. But I do think it is important to keep certain moments private. I did not take a lot of pictures as an example. We didn't take any pictures in the delivery room, you know, whenever my two kids were born. I know they're a perfectly nice, earnest, loving, spiritually deep people who think that that is a good thing to do for their own reasons, and so I'm not going to judge them. I'm just going to say that that is a bargain that all of us have to sort out for ourselves.
Yeah. Gary in Milwaukee is next. Gary, what's your question or comment?
I absolutely, you know, try not to put anything online, you know, as far as social media for myself personally. I do love to take pictures on vacation for probably that same reason that you just said. You know, you want to remember that and you want to look back at it, you want to capture it. But I usually hold on to those and I organize them and I share them back to the family and friends that I was there with, kind of like a little souvenir later on. I'd like to, you know, print them out and they always come back to me and say, well, why don't you post it online? That way I can have them all in one place or share them. So I'm getting a lot of pushback that way. I wanted to share that. And also I did that same experience on that kayaking trip where I wasn't allowed to bring any kind of photographic equipment. And I thought, well, this is probably the most beautiful area I've ever been in that I'm missing out. Kind of made me think, you know, well, how can I get this out on paper to share? Do I start drawing it out or do I start painting it? Do I look at other creative ways to share that experience? Or do I just grab something online to share where I was at so I could tell people about mm-hmm. it?
So. Interesting, Gary. So two things there. One, let's start out with maybe the expectation by others for you to share your life on social media, even if you don't want to. Danny.
There is that urge, isn't there? But I thought that there was a pretty profound moment in a summer movie last summer, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. There was a photographer in that movie played by Sean Penn, and he is up on a mountaintop, and he's been waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for a snow leopard to appear so that he can photograph it. The snow leopard appears, and Sean Penn's character puts his camera down and chooses not to photograph it, and Walter Mitty says, my gosh, you've been waiting all this time to photograph this this snow leopard. And Sean Penn's character, the photographer, says, you know, sometimes I just look at things just for me. And what he was saying was, I think the experience is actually going to be compromised if I photograph it. I'm going to actually miss it. And so I think the fact that scene is in the movie and the fact that it resonated with people, I think all of us are struggling with this basic question of how much do you live your life and how much do you document it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Gary was saying he struggles, too, if he doesn't have a camera or something. How else is he going to document it so that he doesn't forget maybe the utter beauty that he observed on that kayak trip and everything? How do you do it as a writer? How do you go back and capture in as much detail as you can the type of experience that you had while you were unable to document it in real time?
I think sometimes the answer is that we don't remember things perfectly. And that's really part of the magic, isn't it? I mean, I know that all of us have family stories about something that happened to Grandma or Aunt Sally 40 years ago. And every time the story is told, it's elaborated, and it becomes a sort of a family mythology. And I'm sure that there are many moments in my life that seem indelible to me, and yet I'm sure that they didn't happen exactly the way that I remember them. But I think that's sort of part of the experience of being human, is that we develop our own mythologies about who we are and who our family is. And I think to the degree that you are always documenting it, I think that to some degree it can become kind of prosaic, it can become kind of clinical. If everything's documented, sometimes it's nice to have that experience where memory meets imagination, and those spaces become more easy to access if we're not holding a camera in front of us all the time. That's something I throw out for consideration.
Well, in our last minute here, we started the interview by talking about Mark Twain and the line he drew as he was specifically asked to offer his dispatches from another part of the world. But some of us just can't let go of the smartphone and can't stop tweeting or posting about what we're doing. What advice do you have for people who just can't disconnect?
Start small. You know, I think a lot of people, I think that they have to go cold turkey. Start putting that phone away for 10 minutes. And maybe 10 minutes can become 20, can become 30, can become an hour. But I would start small. You don't have to go cold turkey. Just try to set a few minutes aside. And I think you'll find it's a lot easier than you think it is.
Well, Danny, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your thoughts with us. We always enjoy hearing from you. What will you be spending the rest of your summer with? How will you be spending it before Labor Day?
Here in Louisiana, school starts at the end of August. My son is back in school, and so we're sort of already in a kind of an autumn rhythm, but we're going to have a barbecue and go swimming on Labor Day, and that'll be the capstone of our summer, and it's been a great summer. And,
great.
Always enjoy connecting with Wisconsin Public Radio, and I hope that you folks enjoy the rest of your summer.
You too. We enjoy talking to you, and we'll have you back sometime. Danny Heitman is a writer, and his recent opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal is called "Have You Twittered Away Your Summer?"
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. News is next on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.